When a soldier on the Western Front wrote to a London newspaper in 1915 saying he was lonely and would appreciate receiving some mail, the response was immediate and incredible. The newspaper concerned actually published his name and his regiment, and within weeks he'd received 3,000 letters, 98 large parcels and 3 mailbags full of smaller packages. And this week on this podcast, Tales from the Battlefields, by me, Terry Wenham, I wanted to look at some of the letters, individual letters, that were sent to and from the battlefields, and also a few about the soldiers after they had died. This was an absolutely crucial process that did almost as much for the British Army of winning the war as did the guns, the bullets and the shells that were sent up. Because the mail system, which at the peak of the war was producing or delivering 12 million letters a week, helped keep the morale of the soldiers high. And without the morale of the soldiers, each and individual one of them, there's no way that Britain, that the Commonwealth, could have won World War I. So how did they do this? At the outbreak of war, as early as that, the War Office must have realised that delivering letters to and from the front line would have been absolutely crucial. So they created a special sorting office in London's Regent Park. It was a massive wooden hut and it covered several acres, and it was called the Home Depot. And over 2,500 staff were employed there, mainly women, whose job it was to sort the post. Outward mail was sorted by military unit. Each morning, the bosses would be informed by Whitehall of the latest movement of ships and battalions on the Western Front and beyond, and that would ensure that the post would be sent to the right place. They used a fleet of 3-ton army lorries to take the mail to Folkestone or Southampton, and their ships would take it across to depots in Le Havre, Boulogne and Calais. And then there would be trains running backwards and forwards to Picardy and to Ypres, under cover of the darkness, dropping some of the mail off en route and unloading the rest at railheads. There, regimental post orderlies would sort the mail at the roadside, and carts would be wheeled to the front row and deliver it to individual soldiers. And the idea, the objective, what they were trying to achieve, was to hand out letters from home with the evening meal. And it said that no matter how tired and hungry the soldiers were, they always read the letter before eating their food. Going back the other way, letters were collected from the men from field post offices. The mail was date stamped with a field postmark and sent to the base post office for its journey home. Now, at the beginning of the war, every single letter was opened and read by a junior officer, and then it was read again at the Home Depot to ensure there was no information that would perhaps give away secrets to spies about troop movement or casualties or forthcoming battles. Now, eventually, the army introduced what they called an honour envelope, which meant the letter would only be read in London, and it meant that none of the junior officers that were under, or they reported to, would read the personal remarks or personal comments that were making to their families back home. So that's a very short summary of how the process worked, but let's now start by having a look at some of those individual letters and what it meant. Most of these letters are written by soldiers on the eve of battle, in particular Battle of the Somme, back to their loved ones at home, usually their wives. And it gives us an insight into how those men were feeling and how they felt about their families as they were about to undertake the greatest and, in so many cases, the final challenge of their lives. After being hidden for nearly 65 years, one of World War I's most touching and poignant love stories was unravelled by a website called Forces War Records. For some months, Roger Potts and his wife, Jenny, had been trying to trace the story of his grandfather, Frederick Swannell. They had scant details about his service in the Great War, really just his name and his army number, but then they found a letter. It was a fragile and fading love letter that was written by Lance Corporal Frederick Scannell of the 13th Battalion of the Essex Regiment, and it was to his beloved wife that he called Nell. Roger's mother had chanced upon it following the death of Nell in 1981 when she was 98 years old. She'd found it tucked away in a handbag. The grieving widow had carried it every single day of her life after Frederick's tragic death in the trenches at Arras in April 1917. So touched were the family with this discovery that they placed the original letter alongside Nell in her sealed coffin, but they did keep a copy of it as a keepsake and also for future reference. The letter is beautifully scripted and it speaks volumes about the personal cost of the war and the terrible physical and mental toll that the First World War had on everybody that fought there. Lance Corporal Swannell was clearly most fearful that he'd never return home, not only to Nell, but his five small children. Frederick and Nell had a son, also called Frederick, and small four daughters, Ellen, the twins Elizabeth and Emily and Charlotte. Frederick Swannell Jr. was known to live with his grandparents due to a busy home life and the logistics of looking after four girls of a similar age. Frederick went into battle during the Battle of Arras on the 28th of April 1917, and he was aged 35 years old, but he was declared missing, presumed dead, one of 150,000 casualties during this battle at Arras in 1917. This is the letter, the last letter, that he wrote home. My dear darling Nell, I'm writing these lines hoping to find you and all our dear little ones in the very best of health. I'm very sorry to know that you've not been getting much news from me, but love, I write to you all I can. At present, the conditions where we are in now do not get much chance of writing any letters. Well, love, my foot is progressing very slowly, but lightly I've been in very bad in health, for the conditions I have to go through out here is gradually telling upon my constitution, for I reckon I've stood it well up until now, but I feel as I'm getting beaten. Oh, love, how I wish that this terrible anxiety and suspense was over, for I do long to be with you and our dear little ones, who are continually in my mind. It is, as you state in your letter, it is a shame that we should be parted for such a long time. And I've done over my bit, as you know, but it seems no matter how long or what we've been through out here, they are never done with you. The men we have got with us now have only been out here for 2 months, and they've done nothing or been through anything yet, but they are continually grousing and fed up with it. They've been forced to join the army, so you can guess what they are like. Well, love, let us put these troubles aside and hope for a peaceable time for us, both and for all. Or if I'm lucky enough to get through it all right, I hope to have a loving and happy life with you and our dear little ones. For you know I love you, and I always will, and I know you do for me, and I approved it with the little ones. Well, love, this is all at present, with my very best of love to you and my little ones. I'm your ever-loving husband, Fred Swannell. Kisses for you and my little ones. And then there's about 20 kisses, and he hasn't finished yet, because he signs it, love you all, love you all. When the letter was uploaded onto the website that I mentioned earlier, Roger's wife Jenny commented on his behalf. She said that every time my husband and I read Frederick's letter, it brings a lump to our throats and tears to our eyes. It vividly illustrates the horror of his life at the front and of his desperate wish to be home with his young family. And Jenny went on to say that we want to share the story so people are aware of the terrible times these brave young men live through. So hopefully we've done that by including the story of Fred Swannell in this podcast today. And the sad fact is that poor Nell never really had closure, because Fred, her husband, was one of many thousands whose body was never recovered from the Battle of Arras, and he's one of 35,000 missing soldiers that are remembered on the splendid Arras Memorial. She never had closure. She never found out for definite what happened to her loved one. But as we said, she kept that letter with her in her handbag for the rest of her life. And it's still with her now. It is widely recognised by military historians that the latter stages of the Third Battle of Ypres, what we call the Battle of Passchendaele, were probably the worst conditions and the worst experience that any British, Commonwealth or even German soldier has ever experienced in history. These are the iconic images that we see of the Battle of Passchendaele, with the soldiers fighting their way through the mud where trenches had ceased to exist and were just joined up shell holes. The winter, the autumn rains had turned the battlefield into that terrible quagmire that when you visit there now, it's impossible to imagine. And one of those soldiers that attempted to fight there was Private Albert James Ford, service number 21336, and he was serving with C Company of the 14th Battalion, the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and he was 40 years old. And just before he went into battle on that day, on a piece of paper, a scrap of paper, really, he wrote the final letter home to his wife. And this is what he said. "My darling, if this should ever reach you, it will be a sure sign that I've gone under. And what will become of you and the chicks, I do not know. But there is one above that will see to you and not let you starve. You have been the best of wives, and I loved you deeply, and how much you will never know. Dear heart, do think sometimes of me in the future when your grief has worn a bit, and the older children I know won't forget me, and speak sometimes of me to the younger ones. Dearest, if the chance should come your way, for you are young and good-looking, and should a good man give you an offer, it would please me to think that you would take it and not grieve too much for me. I should not have left you thus bringing suffering and poverty on a loving wife and children, for which in time I hope you will forgive me. So, dear heart, I will bid you all farewell, hoping to meet you in the time to come, if there is a hereafter. Know that my last thoughts were of you in the dugout or on the fire step. My thoughts went out to you, the only one I ever loved, that one that made a man of me." And Albert, of course, was killed in action, as he predicted, on the 26th of October 1917. His wife, Edith, she treasured that letter. She never did remarry. And as she lay dying in February 1956, she said that she could see a long-lost husband, Albert, in the corner of her bedroom. And as I read that letter and those notes, it's a boiling hot day. It's during the day that we're told is the hottest day ever in the United Kingdom. But it's brought me out in goosebumps as I read those last thoughts of Albert before he went over and met his death. And sadly, like so many others, he may still be there. He may still be on the Passchendaele battlefield, because he has no known grave, and he's one of those whose name is remembered on the Tynecott Memorial, not far from where Albert was killed. I discovered a photograph of Albert and his wife Edith, and also the family group without Albert, and a copy of the letter that he wrote. So I'll upload those images to the podcast page on my website, www.terrystours.co.uk. This next story comes from a book written by Jane Ainsworth and is called The Great Sacrifice, The Old Boys of Barnsley Holgate Grammar School in the First World War. And her book tells the story of Private 1064 Stuart Swift. And he was in the 12th Battalion of the Yorks and Lancasters Regiment, which is the Sheffield City Battalion. And he'd previously worked for the Midland Bank, following in his father's footsteps, and he enlisted in that battalion, one of the Powell's regiments, on the 11th of September 1914, when he was 28 years old. Stuart had married a lady called Alice Watkinson in Sheffield in April 1915. No doubt this was during a period when he was doing his basic training. And before he went over to France, he became a father to James Stuart Morton Swift on the 27th of March 1916. Now, Stuart had then gone to Egypt with his battalion, and he'd not been given any leave to return home since he went over to Egypt in December 1915. Not even becoming a father gave him any special privileges, and there was no chance of him meeting his young son before he went into action with his battalion on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And Stuart wrote home to his wife, and this is what he said: "I so long to see the little chap myself. Everyone seems to think he's a fine specimen. It's nice to think of our little love being of such a happy disposition. I'm glad he has such winning ways. I can see he takes after his little mother in those respects." His last letter home to his wife Maud was written on the 27th of June 1916, so just, 4 days before the Battle of the Somme began. And he said, "I'm eagerly looking forward to getting your next letter, as I expect to get the promised photo you were sending of your dear self and our little darling. Of course, I've tried to picture him to myself, but I have no idea what he's like. But tragically, the proud new father not only didn't meet his son, he he didn't actually receive that photo, because before Maud could send it to him, he was one of those that was cut down before the village of Sayre on the 1st of July 1916. Now, he does have a grave. He's one of the few that went into action that day that has a grave. By the time he was killed on the 1st of July 1916, he was 31 years old, and he's buried in Luke Copse British Cemetery, not far from where he fell. A beautiful spot if you've ever been there. It really is a lovely place to visit. So it meant that young James Swift went through his entire life never meeting, not knowing anything probably about his dad. But he didn't have a bad life, did young James, because he lived until 1983 when he died in Torquay in Devon. He was 66 years old. In his probate, there was over £46,000. So he must have made a success of his life, even without his dad, who, of course, he didn't know. But he would have been very proud of him, I'm sure. There was a private 5026 Daniel Glassman who was serving with the 1st Battalion of the Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry. And he wrote a letter in December 1914 back to his parents in Northampton. Daniel, at this stage, had been at the front for a month, and this was the worrying letter that he sent back home to his parents. "It is simply awful out here. We are making good progress, and we have got the Germans properly in a fix. We are all treated well. We have plenty of cigarettes, and it was good weather. We could be happy. Just imagine what it is to be wet through for days and no sleep or a wash. But we are all contented, because we know that all is being done for us that can be done. We have received nice fur coats, but they have to go wet through. I spent days in the trenches with bullets and shells whistling over my head. I had a narrow escape the first day I went in. A party of us had to relieve another party about 8 p.m. When we were about halfway, the Germans turned a Maxim on us. Of course, we all threw ourselves on the ground. The man next to me was shot through the neck, and a bullet went through my pack. I found it later in my canteen." So in one way, he was saying to his parents, it's terrible. In another way, he was saying that he'd been fortunate. A bullet had gone through his pack, but it hadn't hurt him. Sadly, just a few months later, on the 15th of June 1915, Daniel's luck ran out, and he was killed in action near Ypres, and he's buried in the 1st DCLI Cemetery, which is just south of Ypres. If you go to Ypres, there's a cemetery near the prison called the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery. And there are so many different stories in that cemetery, you could spend all day there, really. But two graves that I always go to and take people to are the graves of the Knott brothers. Now, these two brothers are buried together in the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery, but one of them, Major James Knott, was not killed on the Ypres salient. He was killed about 70 miles away during the Battle of the Somme, on that terrible first day of the Battle of the Somme. And his body was moved to Ypres so that he could be with his younger brother, Captain Henry Knott. Major Knott's story is that at 7:30 on the first day of the Somme, his men advanced. The enemy emerged from their dugouts and opened fire on Major Knott and his men, and over 700 men from his battalion were killed, and including, of course, Major Knott, who was being an officer leading the advance. Major Knott himself needn't have been there. He was a deputy managing director of his father's company, and he'd actually been offered a safe position on a shipping board that was going to be stationed in England, but he refused that. He said he wanted to go and fight at the front. Meanwhile, his brother, Captain Henry Basil Knott, had died in 1915 at a Poppering casualty station after being fatally wounded by a bullet to his head. Now, before his death, Major Knott, the one that died on the Somme, he'd been decorated with a Distinguished Service Order medal in the birthday honours. And allegedly, the night before his death on the Somme, James dreamt of his brother Henry, and on the morning of his death, just before the battle began, Knott wrote a letter to his parents, which, like so many others, he'd marked only to be opened in the event of his death. And this is what he said in that letter. My dearest father and mother, if you are reading this letter, it means that this war has demanded the extreme sacrifice from me. It is not in any sense a message from the grave, because whether I may or may not doubt, I have every faith in the life eternal. Momentous events are looming, and I have a premonition that I may not return to you. I've been dreaming of Basil recently. My medals are yours, but I would like them destroyed when you both join me. My clothes, furniture and motor car must be immediately disposed of. Everything which reminds you of my death must be removed. This is my urgent desire and wish. Your devoted son, Jim. And it was his father, Sir James Knott, who arranged for his son's grave to be moved from the Somme so that he could be with his brother in the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery. But the father wasn't finished there, because if you go to the St George's Chapel, which is just round the corner from the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery, you go through the doors and you'll see a memorial on the wall, and that confirms that the father, Sir James Knott, paid for the tower in St George's Chapel as a memorial to his sons, and he also donated the bells that sit within the tower. A fitting memorial to his two boys that died. There was, in fact, a third brother, Thomas. He was the oldest of the three, and he was also feared dead during the war. But no doubt, to the extreme relief of his parents, he did actually return home at the end of the war, having been released from a prisoner of war camp. This next story is quite a famous one. It concerns a man called Captain Charles May, who was the company commander of B Company of the 22nd Manchester's, the POWs battalion that went into action on the first day of the Somme near the village of Mametz. Now, Charles, or Charlie as he was called, was 27 years old, and he'd kept a pocket diary, and he'd also written lots of letters home to his wife, Maud. And Charlie's diary and his letters have been published in a superb book written by Jerry Harrison, and he called the book To Fight Alongside Friends. On the 17th of June 1916, so what, just 2 weeks before the Battle of the Somme began, Charlie wrote this letter to Maud, and this is what he said. We stay, I believe, about 4 days and then go back and into the line ready for the assault. I must not allow myself to dwell on the personal. There is no room for it here. Also, it is demoralising. But I do not want to die. Not that I mind for myself. If it be that I am to go, I am ready. But the thought that I may never see you or our darling baby again turns my bowels to water. I cannot think of it, even the semblance of equanimity. My one consolation is that the happiness that has been ours. Also, my conscience is clear, and that I've always tried to make life a joy for you. I know at least that if I go, you will not want. That is something, but it's the thought that we may be cut off from each other, which is so terrible, and that our babe may grow up without my knowing her and without her knowing me. It is difficult to face, and I know your life without me will be a dull blank. On the 26th of June, so just 4 days before the Battle of the Somme, he wrote his final letter to his dear wife. And this is what he said. My darling Maudie, just one last little note for some days, since after tonight I will have no chance of writing for the best part of a week. The biggest show of the war is now on. The greatest bombardment the world has ever seen is banging and booming away in the valley and on the hill over yonder. No one has whispered it before, but you'll know all about it and what we have achieved by the time you receive this. At present, we are lying behind the line, waiting to go up for the assault. In the assault, the battalion has the position of honour, the right of the division, and B has been chosen as right of the battalion in the leading line. Lloyd supports me. Worthy was his company in the front line on my left, and Bill Bland is in support of him. I little thought in those far-off days in Morecambe that I should ever rise to have such a trust given to me. The company is the envy of the battalion, and a battalion is of the whole division. To the right of the finest division of the British Army is no small honour, dearest, and I know you'll be proud of it as we are. For myself, Maudie, I pray to God in all humility that I may do my job well, achieve my objectives, hold them, and generally carry out our orders correctly and successfully. For the men, I have no doubts. They, I know, will be splendid. They are as keen as mustard and fit to a turn. All the love and devotion of my heart and soul to you, my dear wife, and to our darling baby. Know that I will think of you all of the time. Au revoir, my love. Your loving hubby, Charlie. P.S. I'm wearing one of your Alexandra roses into action. Worthy is wearing the other. I gave it to him because he liked the idea. Maud replied to Charlie on the 30th of June, the day before the Battle of the Somme. And she replied from her home in Wanstead in Essex, "My darling Charlie, your letter the 26th reached me this morning. And my darling, darling husband, what can I say to you in answer to it? For some time past, I've been dreading such news as you've given me in your letter. Somehow I felt that the time was drawing near for the big move, but I've always tried to put it out of my mind and to think that perhaps you might be spared taking part, that your company, the battalion and division, would hold such an important position in the assault I never dreamed of. And my darling husband, when I think of all the danger you are encountering, my heart thumps with fear. My dearest, I'm trusted in God and praying, baby with me, that you'll be spared to come through these terrible days of fighting and well and return to us, my darling man. I shall not expect a letter from you for at least a week. It was good of you to warn me, my Charlie. Somehow I feel that God will look after you. You know, dear love, that in you I have absolute trust, and I'm confident that you'll bring B Company through with honour and as few casualties as possible. Oh, my darling husband, how thankful I am that at this time I can look back on our few years of married life and know that you were perfectly happy, and to note that we've always been since we first learnt to love. Absolutely all in all to each other." I never realised that you would be going into action yet. Well, the time we have all waited for has come. The papers are full of accounts of raids, artillery work, etc., etc. But so far, no news of a big infantry assault. My darling, darling boy, God be with you. I can only pray and shall only wait with what patience I can. Would it be possible to give my best wishes to your men? If at all possible, try to do so and tell any who come to or near London to let me know their whereabouts. My whole soul goes out to you, my heart's dearest tonight, in love and trust and longing. God will be good to us. He will keep little Pauline's daddy safe. Send me a field postcard if you have not time for more. My own, my love, your wife, Maud." You can probably guess what happened next. Charlie May went over the top opposite Mametz and Dantic Alley, and within a few minutes of going into no man's land, he was mortally wounded by a German shell as he crossed no man's land. And today he's buried alongside several hundred others in Dantic Alley British Cemetery, which is just east of Mametz on the road that leads to Montauban. And it's very near the site of Dantic Alley Trench, which was actually captured by his battalion, his company, on that day, the 1st of July 1916. But their casualties were heavy. It was one of the few objectives that the British achieved that day. And the 22nd Battalion, the Manchester Pals, had suffered 10 officers, including Charlie, and 120 other ranks killed. 8 officers and 241 men were wounded, with another 111 men missing. Dantic Alley is a beautiful cemetery which, like so many others, has got so many stories to tell. But if you do get to the Somme, please go and see Charlie and take with him the letters that you can find on the internet. And just stand there, there's photographs as well that are published on the internet where you can see baby Pauline with her mum and dad, Maud, and Charlie, he in uniform, taken before he went off to the front. Take those photos with you and just stand there and read some of these letters and think of Charlie May, just one of over 19,000 men that went into action that day that were dead by sunset. The good news from the Somme this week is that at long last the Tiquetval Memorial to the Missing has now reopened to the public, having been out of sight beneath scaffolding for probably the last 18 months, getting on for 2 years. So we can now go and properly remember the 72,000 men that are remembered on this beautiful, wonderful memorial. And one of those men is Private John Dewsbury, regimental number 18260 from the 2nd Battalion of the Notts and Derbyshire Regiment, known as the Sherwood Foresters. And John was one of those men that was killed on the 15th of September 1916, the third stage of the Battle of the Somme. And it's a day that's remembered by most people being the first time that tanks had been used in action. And the Sherwood Foresters made some progress that day. And John was wounded. And whilst he was in a shell hole, he found a piece of paper in his pocket and a pencil. And he wrote this letter to his mum. He was a machine gunner. And this is what he said to his mum from that shell hole somewhere on the Somme. "Dear mother, I'm writing these few lines, severely wounded. We have done well and our battalion has advanced about a 3/4 mile. I'm laid in a shell hole with 2 wounds in my hip and through my back. I cannot move or crawl at all. I've been here for 24 hours and never seen a living soul. I hope you receive these few lines, as I don't expect anyone will come to take me away. But you know I've done my duty out here now for 1 year and 8 months, and you will always have the consolation that I died quite happy doing my duty. You must give my best to all the cousins who have been so kind to me for the time I've been out here, and the best of love to Mother and Harry and all at Swinefleet." And then he died. And then the next day, or sometime after, his pals came along and they found his body, and they no doubt buried him on the battlefield, but of course his grave was later lost in the fighting, which is why he's on the Tiquetval Memorial. But they found that letter, and they sent that letter back to his mum, and she no doubt treasured that letter for the rest of his life. It really was a letter almost from the grave. And another man that's also remembered on the Tiquetval Memorial is an officer, Captain Harry Cromery. And he was just 19 years old when he died. And he wrote a letter to his girlfriend Vera, which said, "If you're reading this, you will know that I have been killed. I meant to ask you to be engaged to me when I was on leave, but I was too frightened to say anything. I loved you very, very much and would have done anything for you. Ever your loving boy." And then he was killed on the following day. Now, his intended, or what he hoped would be his intended, was Vera. And Vera went on to find love with another man and she had children. But she kept that 2-page letter for the rest of her life, along with a locket containing photos of her and Harry. Throughout many of these letters, the last letters home from the soldiers, there's a common theme, really. There's the soldiers obviously profess their love for their families, their wives and their children, but they also talk about their doubts of their own ability and hoping that they won't let themselves or their families or their regiment, and most importantly, their comrades down. And we can see that again in a letter, the last letter home, from Major George F. Farron of the Royal Field Artillery. And he's buried in Becourt Cemetery on the Somme, not far from the Loch Nagar crater. He was 34 years old and a regular soldier, and he wrote home to his wife on the 28th of June 1916, and he marked the envelope, as so many others did, "In the event of my death." And this is what he said: "My own beloved wife, we're on the eve of a great action in which A Company has been detailed to take a dangerous post, and in fact the 88th Brigade was specifically selected for it. I'm writing this now in case I do not come out of it. Dearest, you have been the best wife a man could have had, and I was very lucky to have won you. I've always loved you, only, and our short married life was very happy. You'll get a pension for yourself and the brat, and I'm afraid you will be badly off, but as you know, income has not allowed much savoury. Give my ring to Suzanne, and give my mother something of mine any things you should care for that you would like to give. And it was this last few words that really we see so many times in letters home from soldiers. I hope if I go out, I shall go decently, doing my duty manfully and well before doing so. God keep you, dearest. Your ever loving husband, George. Now, a couple of things to note here. He referred to a brat in his letter. The brat is what he called his daughter Suzanne, who was 3 years old. And also that the following day, the first day of the Battle of the Somme, he did actually survive, but was killed just a few weeks later. So it was not just letters to and from the front line that meant so much to the families. So many, hundreds of thousands of letters would have been sent home from a casualty's commanding officer or just a friend. And it gave so much comfort to the families at home to try and understand what had happened to their loved one, and also to understand how well regarded they were by their comrades. And to demonstrate that, I'd just like to quote one letter. And this letter is about Second Lieutenant Harvey Lancelot Swallow. And he was a junior officer with the 10th Battalion of the Yorks and Lancaster Regiment. And he was killed in action on the 25th of September 1915, the first day of the Battle of Loos. He was just 19. He has no known grave and he's remembered on the Loos Memorial. His father was the vicar at the local church where, in fact, I got married in 1991. So I do feel some kind of affinity to this family. One of his comrades was called Captain F. Taylor, and he wrote this letter back to Harvey's mother. Your boy was with me all through the night of the 25th. He was wounded just before dawn on Sunday the 26th. But for some reason said nothing about it. We were all digging ourselves in at the time. I then noticed he was working with the left hand only, and I found he'd been wounded in the right arm. Having made him comfortable, I told him to go to the rear and see the doctor. About half an hour later, he came back and asked me to be allowed to stay. I then told him he had better go to the rear and find the field ambulance. He then left me. That would have been about 8 a.m. on Sunday the 26th. The shell fire was terrible, but I feel convinced he would have found his way back. As the fight surged backwards and forwards over that ground all day on Sunday, it is difficult to say. I too am anxious to discover what became of one I esteemed as a friend and was proud of as a brave and efficient officer. I cannot speak too highly of his conduct during the great offensive. And as I said, Harvey was just 19 years old. He was never seen again. Nobody knows what happened to him. His family hoped, like so many others, that he'd been taken prisoner, was in a camp. But in April 1916, just a few months later, they received confirmation that he had in fact been killed as he made his way back, probably by shell fire. Now, Harvey had a brother called Arthur, and he was serving as an army chaplain. And in November of 1916, he arrived on the Western Front. And on the 11th of April 1918, he went out into no man's land five times under shellfire to fetch in wounded men. He wrote home to explain what had happened. He said, "We hadn't got very far before the enemy spotted us. It was broad daylight and a rifle shot rang out unpleasantly near. I was carrying three big white crosses and went straight on." And he was awarded the Military Cross for his action. In November 1921, the local war memorial at the church, where, as I said, I got married and he was the rector, it was unveiled. And Arthur himself preached at the unveiling of the war memorial. And this is what he said. "The men who came back required no eloquence or tribute. They rarely talked about their experiences because they knew that most people in England did not understand." Another very sad letter home was written by Corporal 69380 Frederick Fleming, who was serving with the 128th Field Company of the Royal Engineers. And on New Year's Eve in 1915, he wrote this letter to his family back home, and it read, "I'm writing this in the last minute or two before we go with several others on a very dangerous mission to a German trench to blow it up. Of course, we may all get back, but I haven't seen barbed wire placed where machine guns are to be sure, and there are grave possibilities. I'm writing this as a kind of possible farewell. if we make the least noise, we are sure to be killed. But he wasn't actually killed on that mission. Didn't even get that far, because he and several of his comrades were killed in an explosion before they left their own lines. An official report said on the afternoon of the 31st of December 1915, the charges were apparently made up by the party, and about 6 p.m. they were working on the cases containing them when the explosion occurred. Lieutenant Muse and three sappers were all killed, and one of those sappers that was killed was Frederick, and the report concluded that, as there's no surviving witnesses, it was impossible to establish the cause of the explosions, although none of the victims were to blame. And they're all buried together. The victims of that explosion are all buried together in one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. 18 months before, Fred's wife Ethel had died suddenly, and they left behind two young girls, Nora, who was just 5, and Marjorie, who was 2 years old. Of course, not all parents agreed with their son's decision to enlist, and one of those who fell out with his parents was a Lieutenant Alan Scrivener Lloyd. He was a Quaker that had been educated at Cambridge University, but he fell out with his parents over his decision to enlist with the Royal Field Artillery. And he explained his decision in a letter to his father. This is what he wrote. He said, "Everyone must put their personal considerations in the background now, and I don't believe you'd be so selfish as to try and stop me doing my part. Possibly you don't realise that this is a life and death struggle with Germany." He went on to say, "I'm the last person to be a jingo and hate flag waving and Union Jack hurrahing, but do feel that I might be useful, with my motor or without it, in case of attack by Germany, and so I've offered my services." Now, in August of 1916, the 4th of August 1916, at the age of 27, he was recceing a forward observation post which had been broken by a German artillery bombardment, and unfortunately he was killed. Some weeks after his death, a gunner, John Manning, who had been with him when he died, he placed a small handmade wooden sign on his grave, and it was these words that he said: "He died as he lived, brave and fearless, a true British hero." That wooden sign still exists, and it's part of the Imperial War Museum collection. And what about on the other side of no man's land, on the other side of the wire? Of course, the Germans too were sending letters backwards and forwards to their families, who were no doubt worrying about them in the trenches. And one of those men that was exchanging letters with his family, and in particular his father, was a man, a young man, a 21-year-old man called Hermann Koopman. And he was in the Ypres area in the latter stages of the First Battle of Ypres in November of 1914. And this is what he said in a rather cheerful letter to his parents. "Father, dear, third letter and the news from October the 31st, which arrived this morning, are lying just next to me. They have made us extremely happy. Thank you very much, my dear parents, for the good news. So you have heard about my experiences from the wounded soldiers, and meanwhile, you must also receive my accounts. I am overjoyed even to receive the smallest message from you, and I'm especially pleased that everything arrives, it seems, as even though often quite late. The chocolate tastes wonderful. I don't want to be immodest, but send more of it. May I list all of my wishes? I believe that I am immodest and have talked too much about such things. But on the other hand, it's all part of our diet, as the food is always the same here, and often there's none at all. It seems that the enemy knows we receive a hot dinner at 7 p.m. when night falls. In the last few days, they have regularly opened such murderous fire around that time that our cooking team could not come near us. And as a consequence, we have had cold pea or bean soup at 8:30. There is nothing else, but we are satisfied. Otherwise, there is just bread, and every now and again we receive a small piece of bacon as a special treat. So you can imagine how delicious your presents are. Please send me more, and plenty. Above all, it is chocolate we wish for, or candy, sausages, and simply anything which is edible. Quantity is more important than quality, and now the joyous Christmas season is approaching, so there will soon be marzipan and other delicious wonders. You might think that your Hermann is quite demanding, but if you could see what's going on here and happy you will make us with your presence, then you will pardon my gluttony. Our battle is hard, And as I read in the newspaper, the subject is being followed with the greatest interest and suspense. How many lives it has cost us? Last night, our third company commander succumbed to his wounds and D was wounded. There is a spot in our trench where 20 soldiers were killed or wounded. God really has been mercifully protecting me until now, and truly I have a premonition that I will see my native country again. And these premonitions often come true. How many have had premonitions about their death, and as I have heard in many cases, were then killed in action? Whatever that might mean, the most important thing is to be brave, and that is what I've been doing so far. Victory is imperative, and thank God that the chances are favourable. The following day, he wrote another letter. Dear Father, thank you very much for your card from the 3rd of November, which I received today. We're still lying in the same trench, but unfortunately the beautiful and sunny weather has changed. It started to rain, which has made our stay far less comfortable. I hope that it will soon be replaced so that we can leave the trenches. Our bones are becoming terribly stiff, and I'm afraid that when it starts raining, I may have to deal with a case of rheumatism, something from which I fortunately have been spared so far. Farewell sincerely. So you can see just in a couple of days, his spirits seem to have dipped quite a bit. And his final letter home seemed to suggest that his premonition had changed from life to death. Because he said, my dearest parents, I must die the most beautiful death. These are my last regards. Farewell and do not weep. I am eternally grateful for all the good that I have received from you. Farewell eternally. I will see you in heaven. Yours, Herman. And that letter was dated the 10th of November 1914, written from the battlefield just half an hour after the assault in which young Herman was gravely wounded. And he died of his wounds a week later, and he's now buried in the Langemark German Cemetery near Ypres. In June 1915, a 19-year-old student from Canada joined the 31st Battalion of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, and in March 1917 he was wounded in the face by gunshot wounds but came back to join his battalion just 3 months later. And on the 6th of November 1917, his battalion was involved in the final assault on Crest Farm, just before the actual village or small town of Passchendaele. And during that battle, Graham Adam was killed and is still missing to this day, and is remembered along with other Canadians that are missing on the Menin Gate in Ypres. But we've got a couple of letters here which gives us some idea of what he was thinking during his time on the Western Front. On the 27th of April 1915, he was out of the line because he was suffering from measles. And he said in a letter home, everyone seems to think that the war was over. Even the troops themselves say so. I wish it were over too, and cannot get up much enthusiasm for killing or being killed, especially the latter. Some of the men indulge in the most gloomy thoughts. It's no use you thinking about ever going back to Canada, they say, because you're not going back. But look at the date of that letter again. The 27th of April 1915, just a few days after the terrible German gas attack not far away at St Julian. And these were the thoughts of the Canadians that had held the line. They probably thought that the Germans were going to break through and win the war, which of course they didn't. Now, the following year in 1916, he's back with his comrades, and he writes this letter. We've just come back from doing several days' duty in the trenches. Out of this period, we spent several days in the very front line that was ever invented. I curse the inventor. I did not rush out, screaming with terror the first time, nor did I single-handedly capture an enemy trench, including 300 of the enemy, and thereby winning honourable mention in dispatches and a probable VC. No, I just stood in the trench with the others, feeling very shaky. How do some people itch to get at the foe? I did not fire a single shot either. There was nothing that I could see worth shooting at. When the shells started to come over, thank goodness, there were not that many. There was not much of yours truly visible to the naked eye. And what was visible wished that he was invisible. And I think that just shows the sheer terror that these men must have felt when they were in the front line. And then, as I say, in that attack on Crest Farm, what's now the Canadian Memorial at Crest Farm, he was killed and remains missing to this day. After he was killed, his father wrote this painful letter about his son. He said, "We used to hear regularly from Graham somewhere in France. He used to write very amusingly and pluckily. He was wounded in the face and was sent to the base hospital. We were very relieved, as this meant he would never return to the front line. Alas, about this time, the Passchendaele offensive took place and every available man was sent up. On November the 6th, we got a telegram to say that Private Graham Adam of the 36th Battalion, he'd been drafted into this battalion, was missing. We made every possible inquiry through Hubert Mann and others, but never heard any trace of him, so presume he must have been blown up by a shell in that terrible campaign. Dear boy, he was anything but warlike and must have hated trench life and all the horrors of war, but was very, very plucky and must have done well, as he was the company runner when he met his end, and his name is on the Menin Gate at Ypres." Now, in front of me, I've got dozens more letters, similar letters. Well, I say they're similar, but they're all describing different things. But I think I'm going to end on that one with Graham Adam, because he was no hero in his own eyes. He was just an ordinary young man from Canada, like all of these young men from all over the Commonwealth and from Germany and the others in the Axis powers that were just there doing their job. Some were volunteers, some were regulars or territorials. And of course, from 1916 onwards, many of them had no choice. They were conscripted. And they must have all at some stage felt like Graham did when he was standing there shivering in the trenches, not knowing what was going to happen to him. And sadly for him, the worst did. And we can only hope that he didn't suffer. And I'm sure they're the thoughts that went through his parents' thoughts when they received the news, the sad news, that he died in action at Passchendaele. So I'm going to leave it there, really. I'm not going to say any more. We'll do another. If this is successful, if people do listen to this episode, then we'll do some more on last letters or letters from home or to home. Next week, we're going to have a special podcast that I recorded on a trip to the Ypres Salient last week, when I guided a couple that come all the way from Melbourne in Australia on the trail of their two relatives that had died at various times during the Ypres campaign. And we also went to Pond Farm, which a lot of people that listen to this podcast will be aware of. And it's where one of the guys there has, in conjunction with his father, built a replica of a British Mark IV tank. So we have an interview there, and we report from the Ypres battlefield and what it's like to follow in the footsteps of your relatives that are still there, and also what's going on at Pond Farm. So that's for next week. But for this week, as usual, I'd like to pay tribute to all of the soldiers, including the young German lad that we've talked about in this podcast, in the usual way, by playing The Last Post. Until next week, thank you.